Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our discussion comes to you from the studios of KALW, Information Radio in San Francisco.
Usually you can find us hanging out around Philosophy Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, we're talking about virtue and vice. John, tell me, what is virtue?
What is virtue? Well, I don't know what virtue is, but a virtue is usually just thought to be a good character trait. And we were Boy Scouts. We learned a whole list of them, you know, trustworthy, loyal. I guess we didn't
learn them all.
And ten others.
Yeah,
ten
such others, and so. I mean, what's the big deal, though, about virtue? I mean, is virtue like a deep and important thing?
Or? Well, you know, I've been teaching ethics for the last couple of years, and I found that there's kind of a paradox. When you talk about virtue and Aristotle's golden mean and the way he thinks about it, students really find that useful. But contemporary ethical discussion usually is either interested in consequences, what's the result of what I'm going to do, utilitarianism,
right,
or rules, Kantianism, you know, or something like that.
Yeah.
So is there a virtue ethics? How does it fit in?
There is a virtue ethics. I mean, it started a long time ago with the Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, all those guys. The entire ancient history of ethics, the entire history of ethics in the Western world is largely concerned with virtue, and it's a new thing, you know. But it's coming back. I mean, there's all these people called virtue ethics. But let's think about what exactly...
Yeah, tell me, what's the difference now?
You said virtue is about character traits. Aristotle said virtue is about being an excellent human being, having skill at living. Think of like and you can't reduce it to rules. Think of like a point guard, right, who's on a basketball court and he's got to decide.
Aristotle didn't play basketball.
No, but he would like this analogy, I think.
Okay.
You're on a basketball court. You're the point guard. You got to decide whether to shoot, pass the ball, drive for the basket, shoot from the perimeter. And there aren't any rules that can tell you that. If you're a good point guard, you just know how to perceive a situation, how to size it up, and make the right decision. And virtue is like making the right decisions in life, because you have this ability to just know what the right thing to do in a
situation. So morality is more a matter of skill rather than assessing consequences or following rules.
Right, it's skill at living, you know.
Now, how about Aristotle's doctrine of the golden mean? Students really like that. That Aristotle thought that for every virtue there were two vices, one of which was too little of something and one of which was too much of something.
Give me an example.
Well, courage would be, how much fear of death do you have? If you have too much, you're a coward. If you have too little, you're foolhardy.
Yeah.
If you have just right, you're courageous. And you know, now, one rather odd one is he says that claiming honors, I reread the works of Aristotle in preparation for the show. Vanity is too much.
Humility.
Pride is too...
It's just the right amount.
It's just the right amount. And humility is too little. Yet I was taught in Sunday school that humility is a virtue.
Well, not
and
only.
Pride it goeth before a fall.
That shows you the difference between the Christian virtues and the Aristotelian ones. You know, but and there might... And some people, they used to think there were womanly virtues and manly virtues. Virtues of old age.
How are we going to choose the right virtues? What are the virtues of old age? Those sound interesting to me for some reason.
Maybe Amy Standen, a roving philosophical reporter, can tell us. She filed this report.
You're promoted colonel. What for?
Take the honor, colonel.
We're near the end of the movie Lawrence of Arabia. Prince Faisal, leader of the Arabs, is sitting down to negotiate with the British for his people's freedom.
There's nothing further here for a warrior. We drive bargains, old men's work. Young men make wars, and the virtues of war are the virtues of young men. Courage and hope for the future. Then old men make the peace.
Faisal is a virtuous man, but he's also an old man. And what comes with that, he tells us, is a surfeit of one specific virtue, caution.
And the vices of peace are the vices of old men, mistrust and caution. It must be so.
Our virtue, taken in isolation, runs a certain risk of destroying itself.
John Langan is a Jesuit priest and a professor of moral philosophy at Georgetown University.
When you are prudent, and that's the only virtue you're really comfortable with, you can sometimes wind up with a caricature in which prudence turns into caution, which is an attitude that may be justified, but often is not. You know, if a parent sees a child after a long absence, you don't want a measured, cautious response. The virtuous person, you know, throws arms around the other person rather than thinking, well, you know, this requires a lot of discernment.
Being virtuous is a lot more complicated than just having virtues. Take Lawrence of Arabia. He begins the movie a young man, valiantly defending the Arabs from invading Turks. Lawrence is a brave and brilliant soldier, but along the way he becomes disillusioned with the bloodiness of war.
We took them prisoners, the entire garrison. No, that's not true. We killed some. Too many, really. I'll manage it better next time. It's been a lot of killing, one way or another.
Which brings up an interesting point. It may be virtuous to be brave, but does it matter which side you're on?
Say the Americans who landed on the beaches at Normandy showed courage. What do you think the Germans who are on the other side of that showed? If they behave as brave, disciplined soldiers struggling against odds, shouldn't we call that courage? We don't want to have a theory which in effect says you apply virtue terms only to people who are on your side. The terrorists, the Nazi officers and soldiers meet a lot of the empirical standards for courageous behavior. They're lacking in some of the moral requirements for saying this is virtue in a strong sense. When you call somebody virtuous, that's a kind of moral endorsement.
Well, sir, go now.
In the end, Lawrence grows sick of fighting and returns home to England. You could say he's become an old man at last. He's run out of one virtue, courage, and developed too much of another, caution, to keep up the fight. For Philosophy Talk, this is Amy Standen.
Thanks, Amy, for that report. The end of that discussion reminded me of an event in our own history a couple of years ago. After 9/11, George Bush gave a rousing speech of indignation, which was perfectly justified. But he called the act of the terrorists cowardly. And I thought at the time, that's a strange thing to say. A guy that cares so much about some cause that they're willing to spend a couple of years learning how to, at least partly learning how to fly an airplane and then sacrifice their own life. That's pretty courageous. But that suggests that, you know, how far does virtue get us with questions of right and wrong? I mean, if they're courageous, but surely they were wrong and what they did was evil.
Maybe the courage was applied in the wrong situation to the wrong context. Because Aristotle says you have to, you know, you're like the point guard again. You're in a situation, you have to know what to do in that. Maybe the wrong thing to do was apply that lack of fear in that situation. But, you know, we should ask our guest to help us with this because she's an expert on these things and we won't muddle through on our own. Our guest today is Julia Driver. She's a professor of philosophy from Dartmouth University. She's author of a very nice book about virtue called Uneasy Virtue. It has this view that most people who endorse virtue ethics are not consequentialists. They don't think it's just the consequences. She thinks it's the consequences that somehow make virtue important. So let's bring her on. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Julia Driver.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Hi, Professor Driver, or Julia, if I may.
That's fine.
Okay, Aristotle, virtue. I mean, was this really a good idea or just kind of a byway in the history of philosophy?
Well, actually, even though I disagree with him, Aristotle's one of my favorite philosophers of all time.
Yeah.
And I think his discussions of virtue are extremely illuminating and interesting. I mean, I don't think that his theory is the right theory, but I certainly think it's worthwhile studying. And he says a lot of really interesting things about virtue that I think are true.
What would he say about our puzzle here from Amy Standen's report about, you know, the guy or John's thing about 9/11? The courageous guy who flies into a building killing a bunch of innocent people. Should we laud that display of courage as virtuous?
Yeah, I think Aristotle would say that's not virtuous because this individual's goals were evil goals. They were bad goals. So even though he did have some of the characteristics that we intuitively associate with courage and with being virtuous, because his goals were corrupt, he wouldn't qualify as genuinely virtuous.
So you can't be virtuous unless you act for certain good ends or something like that.
Unless you act for good ends.
And how do you decide which are the good ends?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that if we're sticking to what Aristotle believed, what would normally happen is someone would be raised in the appropriate sort of family context with people who had good values, right? And what counted as being kind or being generous or having good political ends and so forth would be understood by the time the person grew up and was able to make their own free choices about their actions. On my own view, I think that a person may be performing actions that achieve good ends, although they may not themselves be in a position to recognize that. But Aristotle would not endorse that view.
Wait a minute. So you think a person may be... So Aristotle would say you can't be virtuous unless you act for good ends. You'd say, and you have to recognize that they are good ends, I guess, right? You can't just accidentally
you can't
bring
acting,
about a good...
Exactly. You can't be acting in ignorance on Aristotle's view.
Let's just bring this a little down to earth.
Okay.
ends is a fancy philosophy word for goals, right?
Goals, right.
Okay. So the terrorist end was to, I don't know, bring down the American civilization or at least get the Americans out of Saudi Arabia. That's their goal.
That's what they intended to accomplish.
Well, let's just say get the American troops out of Saudi Arabia. That's not necessarily such a bad goal, I wouldn't think. I mean, it's, I don't know, it's evil, but where did their mistake come in? They were courageous in pursuit of a reasonably acceptable end.
But they also had these goals that were necessary for accomplishing that, right? So, for example, they knew that when they crashed those airplanes into the World Trade Center, presumably they were killing lots of innocent people.
You know, this sounds to me like there's a room for a moral rule, though, which the virtue ethicists say are sort of secondary or can't be had. Don't kill innocent people. That's a rule.
Sounds to me like maybe there's room for a little consequentialism here. I mean, that the effect of your act is going to kill thousands of innocent people.
And that's what makes it wrong.
Yeah. Well, where do you come down, Julia?
Oh, I definitely think it was wrong.
Well, that's good.
My rationale is consequentialist. I mean, I have a different account of the virtues than Aristotle. I think that a virtue is a character trait which leads systematically to good consequences.
Yeah.
A character trait. So that's an abiding fact about your character, like trustworthiness or truth-telling, right? And good consequences. Now, who decides what's a good consequence
on your view? That's a good question, but I'm actually kind of neutral on that. With consequentialist theories, you generally have two parts. There's the what's controversial about my view is that I think that that's all there is to virtue, exactly.
How can you believe that?
You're kind of a virtue utilitarianism, a rule utilitarianism.
Yeah.
In philosophy, someone says we should follow the rules, but the rules we should follow are the ones with the best consequences.
Exactly.
And you're saying we should be virtuous, but the virtues we should have are the ones with the best consequences.
Exactly.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah. and I happen to think that people can have these traits which achieve these good consequences or bring about these good consequences, although they're not aware of the ways in which their actions actually do bring about the good consequences. So here's an example. It's actually something that you guys brought up, the example of whether humility or modesty would count as a virtue.
Okay.
And on Aristotle's view, it's not a virtue because if a person is sort of overstating how good they are in some way, right? Like, philosopher X says, I'm the greatest philosopher of, the 20th century or something like that, or the 21st century.
I think I know that guy.
I know him too, but I'm not going
to
mention any names.
No. Hey, Julia, I'm gonna let you finish that thought after the break.
Okay, sure.
Okay, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking with Professor Julia Driver of Dartmouth College about virtue. She thinks that it's the consequences that matter and character matters only relative to consequences. What do you think? Join our discussion.
Call us at 415-841-4134 or go to our website, www.philosophytalk.org, and send us a comment.
And while you're on that webpage, look around at all the other cool stuff we have up there. Philosophy Talk will be right back.
Yes, I'm always true to you, darling, in my way.
That was Ella Fitzgerald singing Cole Porter's famous song about the virtue of fidelity. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk. Today we're talking to Professor Julia Driver about virtue.
Aristotle thought virtue was the key to happiness. What do you think? Give us a call.
The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can go to our webpage, www.philosophytalk.org, and send us a comment. Julia, before the break, you were talking about how it's the consequences, and character matters only to the extent that it brings about consequences or something like that. I want to set that up for you a little bit, give you a chance to go back to that, but I want to ask you this. Look, the things we blame people most for are the things that are revealing of their character. If you do something out of a fixed character, right, if you slap me in the face because you're just a nasty person and you like to slap people, that indicates something about your character. I really hold you responsible for that.
Why is that? I mean, that's probably going to be because you think that I have this tendency to go around slapping people in the face,
right? Because you have a certain character, that is.
Right, and that character comes out in inappropriate actions.
That's true. That's right? True. But it's not the action per se. Because if you slap me in the face accidentally,
right?
I mean, it's the same action. You slap me in some sense. It's the same physical happening. But I don't hold you. Don't resent it as much.
But on the other hand, Ken, I mean, suppose I have the character trait of just thinking ill of everyone. I'm walking around thinking ill of you. you don't blame me for that as long as it doesn't lead to some overt action. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just my own business. It's too bad for me.
Anyway, I was trying to set you up to go back to your point.
And I was trying to get in the way.
I mean, what I wanted to argue sort of against the Aristotelian view, too, was that I thought it was putting way too many psychological requirements on virtue. So in his view, for example, if somebody's modest, either they're lying to you, right? They're saying, look, I'm not really that great, or my book isn't really that great, when they think that it is. Mm-hmm. Or they're making a mistake, right? They're underestimating how good they are in some respect.
What?
And so in his view, neither of those can be virtues, right? Lying's not a virtue, is incompatible with virtue. Making an epistemic mistake like that is incompatible with virtue. And what I want to say is it's perfectly compatible with virtue as long as you can point to some benefit that modesty produces. And for me, it seems plausible to think that it helps in social interaction, because it's just not a good thing to have somebody going around saying how wonderful they are, even if they really are wonderful.
So Julia, there's this debate between the Christians and the Aristotelians about pride, yeah. Pride and humility. The Christians
right.
think pride is a vice and humility is a virtue, and Aristotle vice versa. How does
right.
that come out on your view?
I think that if what you mean by humility is the same as what I mean by modesty,
humility is like me, pride is like Ken, you know.
Okay. Well, definitely it's a virtue.
Well,
yes, humility is a virtue.
But that's strange, uh-huh. isn't it? Because for mm-hmm. Aristotle and for many virtue ethicists, the virtue mm-hmm. is a kind of know-how, a kind of skill at living. So it requires knowledge. It requires this practical wisdom, phronesis, as he says. And that's kind of sizing up the situation and knowing what's required, or sizing up the people and knowing
right.
what's due to them. And all that. And your thing about modesty is when you don't know yourself.
That's right.
So how could that be? I mean, that has nothing to do with virtue. It's a pleasant, maybe it has good social consequences, but what's that got to do with virtue?
Let me just interject with a question for the two of you. I thought I heard something like phronesis, or were you just clearing your throat? Is that a word?
That is a word. That's a Greek word.
That's a Greek word. Yeah, phronesis. Yeah.
Well, thanks. Now that I know
it means
it's a
practical
word.
Wisdom.
Oh, okay.
It
practical
means
wisdom. Yeah.
Skill at living, you know.
Skill
right.
at living. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can
right.
relate to that.
Well, look, I mean, I personally think that there are a lot of problems with that. It's not just my views about virtue. I mean, I do think that modesty is a virtue. I find actually, you know, like I said, I love Aristotle, so don't take this the wrong way or anything.
Okay.
But his discussion of this is kind of funny in some ways, right? I mean, because he thinks that, of course, it's good for you if you're going to live a good life to basically not hide your light under a bushel, you know, to go about proudly, you know, acknowledging your superiority, speaking in a deep voice, right?
Yeah. Yes.
And so there's an extent to which I think, well, if what he's talking about is having a successful political career, then I agree with that.
Yeah.
But I just don't think that that's the right sort of account to give for moral virtue. And being the sort of person that other people really want to be around, right? Now, I don't mean to be endorsing, you know, Hume's test for moral virtue, which I sometimes call the dinner party test.
You got to explain that to our audience.
The dinner party test, and this is just kind of a joke, basically, but you know, if this is a quality for which you would invite somebody over to dinner, then it's a moral virtue.
Right. Good company. The virtue is being,
yes,
good,
right,
being
right.
good company.
Right.
Now,
right.
look, but, I mean, but I think there's, you're right, I think, to reject that as a characteristic for virtue. I still don't think, I think there's something deep in Aristotle, though. I wonder how you can accommodate it. Aristotle talks about virtue as a kind of, again, a kind of skill at living. Living well, doing well, doing, and not just for yourself, but for your circle, right? And mm-hmm. depending on who you are, your circle, it can be your friends, it can be your citizens, right? Living well and doing well. And having a kind of inner skill at doing that. And that skill is a kind of know-how, a kind of practical knowledge. I don't see how you're not endorsing the dinner party test.
Well, let me just interject here. I mean, consider the skill of riding a bicycle. That's a skill, right? It's
right.
a skill. Consider wiggling your ears, right? That's a skill. It's actually somewhat harder to learn than riding a bicycle. But one of them's socially useful, as Hume would say.
Oh, I know.
Or has good consequences. I mean, it sounds like a reasonable test to me.
Oh, yeah, but John and Julia, of course. Aristotle is not like Kant. Kant says there's nothing good, you know, what is unqualifiedly good except the goodwill. And the consequences of that goodwill don't matter. They're completely irrelevant. The consequentialist says everything matters. The consequences
only
are all only consequences that matter. Aristotle is the guy that's in between.
Yes,
right?
He has a mixed view, right, right.
So, I mean, he's going to let that in, the consequences in, but the main thing is the production of the consequences through the exercise of practical wisdom.
Right. There's a really great article that was written by one of my thesis advisors, Jerry Schneewind, called The Misfortunes of Virtue.
Uh-huh.
And he raises a problem for the sort of view that you're seeing in Aristotle, too. In a society in which, you know, it's sort of a heterogeneous society, it doesn't look like Aristotle's view really is going to be that workable because, like you say, it involves this kind of correct perception view of virtue. You know, the virtuous person sort of sees, correctly perceives what's morally significant, just like the point guard, right?
Uh-huh.
And acts accordingly. So what you have with non-virtuous people is a kind of lack of correct perception on
right.
this view, right? And so Jerry points out that what this means is that if you're arguing with somebody over something, right? You're sitting there talking about capital punishment or abortion or whatever, and they're disagreeing with you. On the Aristotelian view, you've got to think of them as vicious.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that follows.
And because they're just not seeing it.
That seems a little hard.
That's Jerry's point, was that that is just doesn't seem appropriate. I mean, you know, for some disagreements it seems appropriate, but not for all disagreements where you simply think that your opponent isn't correctly perceiving something.
Okay,
right?
Let's let our callers in here to ask the question whether when you have a disagreement with someone, is the person with whom you disagree vicious to your virtuousness? Give us a call. We're talking with Julia Driver of Dartmouth College. You can give us a call at 415-841-4134, and some people have done that. Joel in Sonoma's in the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Joel.
Hi. Let me start this way. I've been at my original question has kind of been eclipsed by your conversation. I've been trying to follow it. What I like about virtue ethics in the Aristotelian tradition is the notion that you can learn to be moral. That this is something teachable, and that you can acquire virtue by following good models and by practice. The notion of a virtue as an acquired character trait that's acquired through practice.
So that seems plausible to you. Are you a teacher?
That seems plausible. And what I think I understand about Professor Driver's theory is that the question of what makes this sort of practical wisdom moral is the one that she's trying to account for with her consequentialism. What I'm wondering about is whether she sees any light in looking at virtues in terms of a kind of Platonic model, where what makes a particular character trait qualify as virtuous is that there's a measure of self-control or self-restraint imposed by the calculating part of one's
soul.
Joe, you got a mouthful there.
Yeah,
you're going to have to untangle
some
of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I actually reject that view because
help us understand
what
the view is.
Yeah, the view that a lot of people, it's a very common view, that a lot of people have the view that in order to be virtuous and to be acting virtuously, the agent has to basically deliberate about what they're doing,
mm-hmm.
right? And it requires some kind of self-control, for example.
Okay.
It's kind of this idea of fortitude being necessary to virtue. In fact, I think there was a view that, you know, God couldn't have virtue on this account because God didn't have anything to control. You know,
he didn't have anything to overcome.
Yeah, he had no bad impulses or anything like that to control. So he didn't need fortitude. You know, I mean, it just wasn't something that was required.
So this this Platonic idea sounds like a foreshadowing of the Christian idea that you know that virtue means kind of resisting the sinful impulses in us.
Yeah, well, I don't know that I would say Platonic, but that the caller seemed to be referring to that. So, Joel was referring to that, and I think that of course a virtue can frequently involve self-control, but I don't think it has to. Basically,
yeah.
I don't think it's necessary to it. I think there are all kinds of spontaneous traits that, you know, we view as virtues. People who are naturally kind and benevolent, and their impulse is to reach out a helping hand. Those people we want to say they're virtuous, even though they're not sort of thinking about it. They're not deliberating. They're not controlling the impulse.
Julia, yeah. Joel made another point, which was about the learnability of morals. He thought that the virtue ethics made it easy to understand how we can teach people to be moral. Why is it better than either a rule-based or a consequentialist-based ethics for that reason?
I don't think that it is superior for that reason. I think that any account of the virtues that you see either in the utilitarian tradition or the Kantian tradition or the Aristotelian tradition, you know, will be able to have a reasonable account of moral education. I mean, that doesn't seem...
they're all going to have different accounts, because one of the things you do with Aristotle is put yourself in the company of virtuous persons and imitate them. Do as they do, and there aren't any rules. There's another caller in the line, Kevin in Berkeley. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi. Forgive me for going back to an earlier point. I was listening with great interest, but I was interested in the point that Professor Driver made about the pilots, the 9/11 pilots, who were not... courageous, or they were not virtuous because of the taking of innocent life. I'm curious what she thinks about the taking of innocent life in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Okay, Julia?
Government.
Okay, well, this is getting into complicated territory, but if you're looking at it from a consequentialist perspective, the idea would be, could you justify the loss of innocent life that was, I presume, not intentionally inflicted in the case of the Iraq War? Now, I really don't know about that, but I'm presuming anyway that the public justification is that when we drop a bomb there and kill innocent people by accident, it is an accident, something that's completely not intended on the part of the people that are dropping those bombs. Whereas in the case of the terrorists, they knew what they were. They knew that they were going to be killing innocent people. Those deaths were intended.
Yeah,
and there was no. Yeah. So again, I don't know the facts of the case of what he's talking about. Maybe there are some cases
there's a distinction between if you're a soldier on the ground in Iraq.
Right.
It seems to me you can be a virtuous person even if the Iraq War is somewhat misconceived.
But
it's not clear that you can be a virtuous person and decide to go to war in Iraq on certain assumptions. I mean, on the basis of flimsy evidence or something.
We don't know all the facts, but if we kind of iron them out,
it seems like, we can have one war and some virtuous and some not so virtuous.
You can join our discussion
by calling 415-841-4134. You can also go to our website, www.philosophytalk.org. Click on the comments button, and you can join our conversation online. We're discussing the question whether, I mean, this is asking, actually, Julia, how deep does virtue ethics go? I mean, on both sides of a morally divisive issue, like the war in Iraq, you can have courageous soldiers. You can have the terrorists who exercise great courage. Now, that doesn't seem to end the moral debate about who's right and who's wrong. Merely being virtuous, you know, seems not very deep.
Well, and that's why some people have a problem with virtue ethics, because, you know, the criterion for right action on some accounts is, you know, like Rosalind Hursthaus's account, is the right action is what the virtuous person would do characteristically.
Right.
Right. Now, and so then that doesn't seem...
doesn't seem enough.
It doesn't seem enough, right.
So why do we care? Why do people care about virtue then?
Let me break in here, because I think we're getting a little off. I mean, part of modern ethics seems to be this idea that there is an answer. What act is right and what act is wrong? And what you're saying is an objection to virtue ethics is they can't always supply an answer to that question. Should I tell this person the truth? That's what a trustworthy person would do. Should I be compassionate to this person and lie to them? That's what a compassionate person would do. Mm-hmm. So being virtuous, even if I'm good at it, doesn't resolve all these problems. But I would say maybe modern ethics is wrong in thinking that there is always a right answer or a right act. Maybe it's fine to be compassionate. It's fine to be trustworthy. But it's wrong to be manipulative. Yeah. Maybe that's all there is to be said about it.
And that's what Hursthaus believes, actually. She thinks that it's actually an advantage of her account that you get a lot of different right actions. You know, so sometimes the right thing is to be honest, and it's also to be compassionate, even when those are incompatible.
I'd like to hear from our callers on this point. Call us at 415-841-4134 or go to our website, www.philosophytalk.org. We're discussing the question now of how far virtue ethics go. So, I mean, John is suggesting that maybe it goes far enough, even though modern consequentialists and modern Kantians think it doesn't go far enough because they think it doesn't go far enough. You can say, well, that's virtuous, but was it the right thing to do? It's what a virtuous person would have done, but was it the right thing to do? You know, it was courageous to fly into that building, but the question still remains unanswered. Anyway, join our discussion. Julia.
So can we make a distinction between, like, metaphysical and epistemic?
Sure, if you help us explain that.
You can talk about sort of this metaphysical messiness as opposed to epistemic messiness. Mm-hmm. And even a utilitarian is going to agree that epistemically things are messy, right?
That means it's hard to know. Epistemic.
Yeah, it's hard to know.
What
I'm sorry.
To
yeah.
Do.
Yeah, it's hard to know what to do. So sometimes you may come up with a range of, you know, 1 to 10 actions, all of which seem they could be right.
Right. Yeah.
But you're right. The utilitarian is committed to metaphysically when, you know, there actually is one of those actions which is the right action, but you just may not be able to figure it out. Okay. And so you won't be blameworthy if you happen to pick the wrong one.
Right, right. Our guest today is Professor Julia Driver of Dartmouth College. Join our discussion. The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or go to our webpage, www.philosophytalk.org. Click on the comment button and send us an online comment. Philosophy Talk will be right back.
Halos and horns, shouted by Dolly Parton. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing the concept of virtue with Professor Julia Driver of Dartmouth College. You can join us by calling 415-841-4134. And Rose in Oakland on the line did just that. Rose, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Yeah, hi, thanks. Julia, I was interested in your consequences twist on this, particularly with the Iraq war thing. Okay, so if these killing civilians is accidental, if you look at the statistics of modern wars, most people who die are civilians. So far in Iraq, over 5,000 civilians, and you know they way outnumber the combatants. And so what would be your twist on that? Now the soldiers are thinking, well, we're defending America against an imminent threat, and now they go out there. Maybe they're not, you know, educated about modern wars or the oil equation or anything like that. Maybe they're just, you know, working class. These are not congressmen's sons. They're working class, less educated, and so they go in there thinking that, well, I might kill civilians accidentally, but that's not why I'm here. But then there's a consequences. So what is their virtue in this situation? And what is the president's virtue in this situation? and what is the Congress and Congress's virtue in this situation, being that they, you know, didn't ask questions? Or
thank you, Rose. Thank you. So, Julia, where does virtue lie in this mess that we've got ourselves into?
Yeah.
And how do we decide?
Yeah, I don't know if I should comment on the president's virtue or lack of virtue. Or a lot of it is going to depend on the truth or falsity of the empirical claims that are made. Are we really under an imminent threat?
Let's define the problem, you know, kind of as it's seen nowadays. Let's just say there were no weapons of mass destruction, but it's mm-hmm. still claimed it's the war is a good thing. Because it toppled Saddam Hussein. So here we have 900 American kids dead, a number injured, and lots of Iraqis dead, but we've gotten rid of a dictator. Was it a virtuous act or not? That's simple for a philosopher to answer, isn't it, Julia?
No, I don't think so. is it going to lead to more people being saved in the end,
mm-hmm.
right? Or is it the case that things would have been better, you know, even though they would have been unjust, but they would have been better in terms of human happiness if we hadn't done this. And that's an empirical question.
See, you're thinking very much, as you are, like a consequentialist, which seems to me a reasonable way to think about problems like
right.
this. Not the only way, but a reasonable way. I don't see how thinking in terms of virtue helps us here. I mean, I know our topic is virtue. I hate to be skeptical. I just don't see that virtue does much work.
Well, I disagree. I think I've done a great deal of work. I mean, I think the problem was thinking, you know, in some kind of Christian save the world way, which was sort of consequentialist. But I think Bush has said, what would a reasonable person do here? What would a prudent person do here? What would a person who really was sensitive to what it's like to lose a son or a daughter or a parent? What would a humble person do? I mean, out loud, what we needed was a little virtue ethics and a little less neocon consequentialism stuff like that.
So he was marching under the banner.
If I may wax philosophical for a second.
But can I ask, what is the virtue doing there? I mean, look, suppose that you go with this definition of right action. That's what the virtuous person would do, what the sensitive, compassionate, caring person would do. That's really what I ought to do, or at least that's one thing that I ought to do. Well, what kind of information are you getting there about what you ought to do? Why is it that the compassionate person, I mean, it certainly can't just be that by definition, right, that that's the right thing to do. I mean, you get the euthyphro problem, right? I mean, you get this, and the compassionate person is picking up on certain reasons. Why don't those reasons then figure into what counts as
You're right, Julia, but I think there's a retort. I mean, look, what did Aristotle say? How do you learn? You don't learn what the virtuous person does by some abstract theory about what the virtuous person would do. You mm-hmm. go in the company of those people, and you do as they do. You practice, and you become that. So George Bush's problem was he wasn't in the company of good men long enough before we put him in this office.
Well, I think America's problem is we elected somebody who was obviously not particularly good at much of anything, and there was no reason to think he'd be good at the kind of judgment that's required to be a virtuous president.
Okay. VJ in Palo Alto, why don't you join us and get John off the hook here before the VJ, welcome to Philosophy Dot.
Hi.
What's your comment or question?
I had two comments. One is there was a question about how do you decide what is a virtuous action? And there I wanted to bring up this idea of telos, or the end of one's life, as the old Greeks talked about, including Aristotle. And the telos that Aristotle proposed was this idea of eudaimonia, which is both happiness and abundance for oneself and one's polis, as in one's community. And so that drives on deciding what's virtuous and what's not. It's not okay, that's one. The other point is why virtue as opposed to the utilitarian or the rule-based approach? The reason for that is to make virtuous action a habit or habitus, or to make it a disposition so that when the right time comes, you act in the correct way, because typically there is no time for deliberating on what is the right action.
Thanks for your call, Vijay. I'm going to take another caller. We'll run through a couple of callers here, and then we'll respond. Gene in Marin, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello.
What's your comment or question?
Well, I want to know if the topic of akrasia has been brought up.
You've got to explain yourself.
Pardon?
Explain what you mean by akrasia, G.
Akrasia is whether you can actually work against your own best interests. In other words, can you knowingly do wrong, or can you actually knowingly do right even? So I wonder if that's been brought up in discussion.
It hasn't so far, but it's a good question.
That was a question that came up for Aristotle and for Plato. How is it possible to have weakness of the will, to know that something is right or even best for you, and then not do it? But, you know, that's kind of a theoretical question. You have to get into a lot of philosophical assumptions to see how it's a problem. For most of us, it's just part of life. Is there a connection there with virtue ethics, Julia?
Well, sort of. There's a little bit of a connection because, you know, on Aristotle's view, it's sometimes taken to be a difference between him and Kant, that on his view, somebody who doesn't have their beliefs and their desires about what's right in sync, right? That person is not one who can fully possess virtue. Whereas on the Kantian view, that almost seems to be his paradigm, at least in some passages, where, you know, the person who really doesn't want to be nice to other people but sort of forces himself to be nice to other people is like a paradigm of virtue. So, it comes up a little bit in the debate along those lines.
Julia, I want to shift gears here a little. We've talked a lot about virtue, but we haven't talked too much about the virtues. Now, you've spent a lot of time studying virtue and developing your account of virtue. What's the most important virtue? Is there a key virtue that all the rest follow from? If you're raising a child, what order of virtues would you attempt to instill? And are there some virtues or things that are thought to be virtues that you've come across and become very skeptical about whether they're virtues or not? And finally, Aristotle thought there were womanly virtues and manly virtues. Is that just political incorrectness, or was it a classical insight?
Well, I mean, in Aristotle's hands, it was political incorrectness. Because the womanly virtues were imperfect virtues, right? Because women were not rationally, you know, capable of having, you know, true virtue. But are there gender-specific virtues? There aren't any that I can think of, but I wouldn't rule it out totally. I mean, on my account, it really turns out to be an empirical issue.
A matter of consequences, right?
Yeah. And so it leads me to another one of your questions. I mean, it did used to be the case that people thought that women, like the virtue of chastity, even though it was important for everybody, was particularly important for women. It was kind of a differential virtue, you know?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think people have pretty much given up on. And I think it is because, you know, and here I'm going to plug my own view, it is because, you know, they don't see the consequences of that trait the same way that people did, you know, hundreds of years ago.
So you're not saying that it's become a virtue for everyone, but it's not so much a virtue for anyone.
Right. I mean, it could still be generally a virtue. It's just not a differential virtue.
Okay.
It doesn't, you know, nothing. It's not more of a virtue for women than it is for men. Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, Julia, you know, we have lots of unanswered questions, and we could continue this conversation for another hour. Unfortunately, we don't have another hour. We're out of time. But it's been a real pleasure having you.
Thanks.
I'm Ken Taylor. We've been talking with Julia Driver from Dartmouth College about virtue.
Thanks very much, Julia.
Oh, thank you.
So, John, what do you think? What did you learn today? Are you wise? Have you given up some of your?
I don't think I've become more or less virtuous, but like whenever we discuss issues in ethics and morals, I'm always impressed by what a welter of facts there are to To take care of. Now our guest, Julia Driver, developed a very interesting account of virtue ethics in terms of consequentialism.
Was it pretty unusual?
It's pretty unusual. You didn't find it too plausible, I didn't think, just from the tenor of your questions.
No, but there's something you said that made me really, think, and I'm not really sure what I think about that. I mean, you said, well, maybe it's just true. I mean, the consequentialist Kantian complaint against virtue ethics is, you know, what the virtuous person would do. Well, here's a courageous person doing something. That's, we can still say it's bad. And the virtue ethicist doesn't have an answer to the question, you know, why is that bad? Mm-hmm. And you said, well, maybe that's, you know, morality just runs out at a certain point. There's what the virtuous person, what the kind, compassionate person would do, and there's nothing further to say. And, you know, maybe that's right. I mean, I think that thought has more credence than...
It's good to be responsible for making you think. That's what the show is all about. The other thing I think I learn every time we talk about ethics is that, you know, there are these interesting theories. There's the consequentialist theory, figure out the consequences for good or bad. The Kantian type theories, what rule is your intention based on? Now there's the virtue theories. They're all interesting theories in terms of explaining things, but I don't think they get very far in telling us what's right in the first place. I mean, if we don't really kind of know what's right, so we can test the theories against our intuitions, we're lost.
Well, but yeah, that goes with the virtue theory, though. That goes with the territory, because you can't spell it out in a rule book. You can't spell it out in the, here is the all the right action. What you have to do is be like that point guard and know how to respond appropriately to the situation. You know what that takes? Practice. Living.
Well, we've got somebody who's very practiced at giving us an overview of complicated philosophical ideas. Here with a trustworthy, reverent, and relevant overview on what has been considered virtuous over time is Ian Scholes, the 62nd philosopher.
Ian Scholes, William F. Bennett's surprise bestseller a few years back was called The Book of Virtues, which featured Bible stories, fables, legends, and speeches that illustrated what he identified as the seven primary virtues. Responsibility, courage, compassion, honesty, friendship, persistence, faith. The word virtue itself is from the Latin virtus, which means manliness, from the same root that gave us virile. Ironically, virtue later came to mean a woman's chastity. Before that, Aristotle gave us the four classic Greek virtues, wisdom, justice, courage, and temperance. The Greek word for virtue was arete, which means excellence, from the same root that gave us aristocrats, who apparently have more virtue than the rest of us. Aristotle also considered a virtue to be a mean between two extremes. For example, the virtue of courage is a mean between the two vices of recklessness and cowardice. The Roman Stoic, Seneca, reduced all virtues to one, prudence, or simple common sense, really. The traditional Christian values came to be faith, hope, and charity. Turning their back on all that, thinkers like Thomas Hobbes and Machiavelli began to look at morality as not how men ought to live, but how they do. As the world became more secular, character-based concepts of virtue began to take a backseat to the larger notion of ethics. Kant and David Hume looked at doing good not as something noble and virtuous necessarily, but as something ultimately practical. This reached a culmination with utilitarianism, the greatest good for the greatest number, a kind of democratization of virtue. In the 19th century, the Hobbesian attitude continued with Kierkegaard and Nietzsche, precursors to existentialism. Kierkegaard searched for faith in life, while Nietzsche strove for power over life, but both located the self as the source for values. Virtue came roaring back in the 20th century with virtue ethics. Various philosophers, reacting to nihilism, existentialism, utilitarianism, and postmodernism, urged a return to Aristotelian values. The old ethical questions were reformulated, though. Instead of what is the right thing to do, became more what kind of person should I be? As a result, we now have two competing sets of virtues. On the right, the virtues of the individual, personal freedom and responsibility. On the left, the virtues of community, tolerance, and pluralism. The so-called culture wars are really battles between conflicting virtues. When will it all end? Let's just remember, patience is also a virtue. At least, last I heard. I gotta go.
Thanks, Ian. If you'd like to lend your voice to this conversation, you can head to www.philosophytalk.org and join our online forum.
And while you're there, maybe give the conundrum button a push. Are you lying awake wondering whether space is finite or infinite, or what happened before the Big Bang? Do you sit in your sixth grade classroom wondering if your teacher really has a mind or is just some kind of automaton? Do you wonder if you're really the same person you were yesterday, or do you have some more practical or ethical problem? If so, go to our webpage, www.philosophytalk.org, and click on the conundrums button. Don't forget to tell us how to reach you. Once again, www.philosophytalk.org. Click on the conundrums button.
And join us next week as John and I explore the brave new world of genetic research and all the moral quandaries it raises.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Its copyright is 2004.
Our executive producer is the one and only Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Nicole Sawaya, Roman Mars, and Alan Farley.
Generous support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Hoover Institution, the Greenwald Foundation, the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
How about the other divisions, Ken? Any generous support
from
them?
Well, let's not talk about that,
okay. John. Also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW Information Radio 91.7, San Francisco's oldest FM station, where our program originates.
The views expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders, but if you believe them, you might become more virtuous.
Our funders are very virtuous, and some of the people at Stanford have a reasonable amount of virtue, too. The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.